Okay, we're recording. Okay, welcome everybody. This is the fifth lecture of Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory, where we go through Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. So in this lecture, we're going to be talking about indirect exchange. So here's the outline of what we're doing. And for those of you just joining us, just remember, Danny Sanchez is not going to typically be watching these interviews. He's watching these interviews, watching these lectures, I meant to say, because he's like exactly 12 hours difference. And so I told him, you know, after I got the hang of how to work the mechanics of this, I said, you know, he doesn't need to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch my lecture. So anyway, he's getting much needed sleep right now. But the point is, if you want to get the PowerPoints, you got to go check your inbox because he's not here to post it. Okay, so direct versus indirect exchange. It's actually, I want to be a little bit meticulous in terms of the definitions here because I think if you really understand the definition, it'll help you think through the logic of it and understand the Austrian position, not just on indirect exchange, but also the origin of money. And because it's something particular to the Austrian school, right? So that Karl Menger literally came up with the theory. So, I mean, if you just look in terms of an encyclopedia on economics and say the origin of money, I mean, they'll credit Menger with this approach. So, anyway, that's partly why we're going to focus on it. So I'm going to take a little bit longer to just make sure you get the definitions down rather than just jumping right into it. So direct exchange means when people swap property that each party intends to use personally. All right, so it doesn't have to just be over consumption goods, okay? So don't misunderstand. Remember, and that's why it's partly confusing, because when we defined what's a consumption good versus a production good or a good of a higher order, I think we may have used the language saying, oh, a consumption good directly satisfies wants, whereas a production good or a factor of production only indirectly satisfies wants, right? So if you're hungry, a coconut can directly satisfy wants, whereas a stick can't. You're not going to eat the stick, but you still value the stick because you can use it to knock down coconuts. Okay, so a long stick can indirectly satisfy your hunger, whereas a coconut can directly satisfy it. Okay, so, but both of those could be objects of direct exchange, right? So if you're hungry and somebody has a stick and you've got a baseball and that person wants to play baseball and that person says to you, hey, let me trade you my stick for your baseball, then you go, okay, and then that's a direct exchange, right? Because even though you're not going to directly use the stick to satisfy your ultimate wants, you're going to use it to indirectly satisfy them, okay? So you're directly using the stick, so it's a direct exchange, right? So it's a little bit confusing, but I just want to be clear, a direct exchange is not confined to consumption goods. The direct exchange can include higher order goods. The critical thing is, so what's the difference? What makes something an indirect exchange? It's not the type of good that you're receiving per se. It's not that whether it's a consumption good or a production good or a lower order good or a higher order good. That's not what makes something a direct or an indirect exchange. What makes it an indirect exchange is if at least one person in the transaction is acquiring the good or goods intending to trade them away again. That's the thing. Okay, so it could be a consumption good or it could be a factor of production. But the point is at least one person in the transaction is acquiring it intending to trade it away for something else. All right, so that's what an indirect exchange is. One other thing I don't have a slide for this, but it's the term barter, B-A-R-T-E-R. That's used a little bit differently by different people. Okay, so I'm pretty sure Rothbard and Man, Economy, and State uses the term barter to be indistinguishable from direct exchange. In other words, I think right in the beginning of the chapter, Rothbard says, you know, there's problems with direct exchange or barter, something like that. So Rothbard seems to be using the word barter and direct exchange interchangeably, but I think other economists or just a layperson probably, when they say barter, they mean something not as strict. They just mean something, a trade not involving money. Okay, so I think, for example, if you're watching a movie about, you know, a post-apocalyptic world after a nuclear war or something, and you saw somebody, you know, going out and, I don't know, trading water to get cans of tuna fish, and then taking the cans of tuna fish and going and trading them to somebody else for ammunition, and the person knew that the people that had the ammunition wanted tuna fish, and the person didn't have tuna fish, the person just had water, and so he went out and traded the water for tuna fish and then traded the tuna fish for the ammunition. I think a lot of people watching that movie, if you said, hey, those transactions, what was that? Would you say those were barter? I think a lot of people would say, oh, yeah, that's barter, because they're not using money. So they're, you know, they're just bartering goods against each other. Right? So I think that's what a lot of people have in mind when they use the word barter, is they mean any trade that doesn't involve money. Whereas what I just described there, that is actually indirect exchange. Because the one person was trading the, water to get cans of tuna fish, and that tuna fish was something, was a medium of exchange, right? So we'll come back to that terminology in a minute, but the person acquired the tuna fish not because he wanted to eat the tuna fish or even that he wanted to use the tuna fish somehow in production, but because he was going to trade it away again. Okay, so clearly that trade was an example of indirect exchange, not direct exchange. And then the only issue is, do you call it barter or not? So Rothbard, I guess, would not call it barter, since he seems to use the word barter to be equivalent to direct exchange, whereas I think a lot of other economists and just the lay public probably would call it barter, because in their mind, barter just means not using money. Okay, so what's happening here is, what I'm saying is, the Austrians, because they really analyze this stuff pretty carefully, they have finer distinctions than I think everybody else does. I think other people just think in terms of, and even economists who aren't Austrians, I think they just think in terms of, do you use money or do you barter? And that's like their twofold classification. Whereas the Austrians realize, no, there's an intermediate case where you're using a medium of exchange that is not actually money. Okay? So I'll just anticipate this, and we'll come back to it, but that's a critical point, and actually I had a tricky multiple choice question that I would ask in them in previous classes, saying that, can you have a medium of exchange that's not money? And yeah, of course you can. That's how money gets going. There's a stage at which there are media of exchange, but not money. Okay, so in that example there, the tuna fish is a medium of exchange because the person is acquiring it just to get something else with it, but it's not money, right? It's not that the tuna fish is now the money in that society instead of $20 bills. Okay, so let's go ahead and move to the next slide. So the drawbacks of direct exchange, and here again, I'll give you like the conventional treatment, and then I'll show you another example that Rothbard brings up, and it showcases the complexity and the depth of the Austrian analysis when it comes to money. All right, so that's kind of the overarching theme of today's lecture. I'm trying to get you guys to see, because of the way Menger solved the theory of the origin of money, the Austrians look at the topic a certain way that I think is a lot richer than a more conventional treatment. Okay, so this is something, you know, what I'm going to tell you right now, this is very conventional. You would get this in a principles class probably if the teacher was a little bit dynamic and wanted to give a sort of, you know, answer the why question. People might stop and say, you know, why is it that we use money? That's kind of weird. When you say, well, because one of the reasons is if you didn't use money, and more strictly speaking, to push it further, if we just relied on direct exchange, okay, so again, that's a much stronger restriction to say we can only use direct exchange as opposed to just saying we can't use money. Okay, so again, I'm beating a dead horse here, but I really want you guys to see this distinction. For a lot of regular economists, and certainly for the layperson, what I just said is it's the same thing, right? Oh, if you're not using money, then it's just a direct exchange or it's barter. And it's, again, there's a distinction between not using money and only allowing direct exchange. Okay. So if we're just talking about direct exchange, there's a lot of problems. And the way to summarize it is to say, in order for a direct exchange to occur, you need to have what's called a double coincidence of wants. So let me type that out. Double coincidence of wants. Meaning, you have to find somebody who wants what you have to offer, and that person has to have what you want to get. Okay, so it's, if you're trying to go find something that you want to acquire and trade, there might be a lot of people that have that thing, but then it also needs to be the case that that person just so happens at that moment to want the thing that you have to offer and trade. Okay, so that you see that it's actually difficult for that to line up. So what these two pictures mean is the way I like to explain it is to say, if we were restricted to a world with direct exchange, think of how hard it would be to specialize. Okay, because that would mean, for example, that you know, let's say there was, could somebody be a dentist? And you say, well, no, that'd be very risky because whenever the dentist got hungry and needed food, he would have to go find somebody that had a bunch of food who had a toothache. Right? Because, again, you mean just think that through, how hard it would be for someone to specialize and just be a dentist and just perform teeth cleaning operations or, you know, pulling out bad teeth or what have you, that would be really difficult to do and support yourself because you would have to, every time you needed something, you needed clothes, you'd have to go find somebody who happened to be offering clothes and who wanted to, you know, procure the services of a dentist right then. And then if you need your oil change in your car, oh, you better go find a mechanic who has a toothache and so on and so forth. You get the idea. So really what would happen is there wouldn't be somebody who was just a dentist all day. Right? There would be a person maybe who was better at cleaning teeth and whatever than other people were, but that person would still have to spend most of his day growing his own food, sewing his own clothes, and so forth. And he wouldn't even have a car to change the oil on because nobody would have built a car at that point. The economy would be too primitive. Okay, so you got to get the idea that once you realize the difficulties of large-scale trade, if you are restricted to direct exchange, then the scope for specialization is pretty narrow. And in practice, and just empirically, you know, this isn't a praxeological thing, but just empirically with the world the way it is, if humans were restricted to direct exchange, there probably would not be professions as we know them. That just about everybody would have to do the main tasks for survival, you know, on his or her own, and then maybe there'd be like one-off cooperative things where, you know, people would do something and then trade the surplus. But that's really, that's it. Okay? Now, Rothbard brings up a different example, and he says it's not just that you wouldn't have specialization in terms of people's occupations and the services they provide. But he also points out, and again, this is not something I think you'll see outside of Austrian discussions, because this involves economic calculation and the idea of capital accounting, and this is a very Austrian type of insight. And like I say, I haven't in practice seen other economists mention this with regard to money, and I don't think that's coincidence. I think that it's because this is the sort of thing Austrians worry about, and that's why they're the ones that stress this kind of thing. So the point is, without money, and even more generally, without indirect exchange, not only would it be very unlikely that people would specialize in terms of conventional professions like being a dentist or a teacher or what have you, but also you wouldn't have large-scale capitalist production. So, for example, how could anybody build a house the way we do in modern times? I mean, obviously, people could build, you know, sort of primitive houses that they personally could build for themselves, but the idea of someone building a house and selling it to somebody else, that just really wouldn't work, okay? Because, and Rothbard walks through the argument here, so let me just make sure you guys follow this, to, again, understand the distinction between a direct exchange versus indirect. So Rothbard says, you know, you could, in a sense, hire people for one-off things if you gave them a quota share in the output. So, you know, it might make sense. I think I'm switching the example here, but, you know, if I'm trying to think of something easy. Like, let's say I have a bunch of, let's keep working with coconuts. I got a bunch of trees in my backyard, and there's coconuts on them, and I want to harvest them. You could define it as a direct exchange, I think, if I said to my neighbor, hey, come on over, two of us getting these coconuts will more than double the productivity. So if you help me, like maybe, you know, I stand on your shoulders, you know, up against the trunk of the tree, and then I just grab a bunch of coconuts and throw them down, and then I'll split it with you. Okay, and maybe that's worth it to me because I can get more than twice as many coconuts per hour if my neighbor's helping me than if I have to do it on my own, right? So I personally get more coconuts for every hour of my labor, even if I'm given 50% of the total take to the guy helping me, okay? And obviously he's going to help me, especially if he doesn't have coconuts in his property because he has to get walked all over, but he gets coconuts, all right? So there, that could be classified as a direct exchange, and that might work. Okay, you can imagine stuff like that happening. And so critically what's happening there is that the final output is divisible. And so that there it works that you can give the various people that are contributing to the product, you can give them a portion of it. But for something like building a house, Rothbard says, in general, that's not going to work because you're going to have to, in order to build it, you would have to get input from workers, from people who are going to give you glass, from people who are going to give you lumber, you know, from people who are going to sell you nails and the hammers and saws and all the other kind of stuff you need in a modern market economy, industrial economy, to build a house. There's all sorts of contributions you need from other people, and you can't start giving out percentages of the house to each person who helped build it. That just doesn't work. Okay, and so that, you know, you should start seeing how restrictive it would be if we were limited to direct exchange. All right, so Rothbard says that, you know, the only way you can imagine it working is if you just so happen to have on you all the different types of consumption goods and other types of goods that the various contractors and workers and so forth wanted from you. So you can imagine, like, if you just so happen to have a bunch of steak and a bunch of apples and a bunch of milk and so on, then maybe you could go up to a bunch of workers and say, hey, can you come help me build this house? And if you do, you know, every day I'll give you some apples and some steak and some milk that you're going to then, you know, go eat or take home to your family. And maybe we can do these direct exchanges that way. And that could work. But even there, I just want to be clear about how crazy the scenario would have to be so that technically it was a direct exchange, all things considered, because you would have to just have all that stuff on hand. You couldn't have previously gone out and thought, okay, I'm going to need a bunch of consumption goods in order to hire all these workers to work on this property, so let me go to the butcher and give him a bunch of stuff and then get a bunch of steak. You know, I'm going to need hundreds of pounds of steak. You can't do that, because then that would be an indirect exchange. You would be acquiring the steak intending to use it to hire the workers in 2 weeks or whatever. Okay, so you can see how right there, boop, that's illegal if we're just considering a scenario of direct exchange. And then also, you could only be doing this to build a house that you were going to live in, or that I guess maybe you could say that you were going to give as a present to somebody. But you couldn't do all that stuff, build a house, and then sell it to somebody, because then what you were doing when you were sort of collecting all of the input from the workers and the people selling lumber and all that stuff, it gets a little bit philosophical as to how you want to classify that. Because are you accepting their labor, intending to resell it to somebody else? You could say, well, no, I'm accepting it to turn it into a house, and then I'm selling the house. So that's a fuzzy area. I'm not sure how Rothbard would classify that. But you see the point in general. Paying the workers to work on your house, unless you just so happen to have all these various consumer goods that you didn't accumulate with the intention of using them as payment, then you couldn't build a modern house without using indirect exchange. Okay, so the point here is, in the last lecture, we walked through how prices are formed in a direct exchange, and we went through that process, and we built supply and demand curves and so forth to come up with the equilibrium price determination. And Rothbard makes an interesting observation in this chapter. He says it's a great mistake, now that we've just walked through here and seen the limitations of direct exchange, and we see how crucial it is to have indirect exchange and to ultimately have money in a market economy. Rothbard says, now we see the mistake in the treatment of most other economists when it comes to price theory. What they do, and this is true, Rothbard's not setting up a straw man, what they do is they imagine the world is one of direct exchange, and they use, you know, those principles to explain the formation of market prices as if everybody were just engaging in direct exchange. And then, as an afterthought, they say, oh, well, but they're in the real world, we use money, so let's somehow incorporate that into the analysis. All right, so let me just make sure you understand what he's talking about. This is true. This is how mainstream economics approaches the problem of price formation, is they, in a sense, look at the economy as if there's no money and the people are just directly trading goods against each other. And then they figure out what is called the real exchange ratio will be. So they'll figure out how many apples trade for how many oranges. And maybe they figure out that, oh, one apple trades for two oranges in equilibrium. That's the equilibrium price. And then when they want to say, okay, but what is the actual dollar price of an apple and an orange, then they use some other approach, like to say, oh, well, how many, you know, what's the quantity of money and what's the velocity of circulation and so on, how many apples and oranges are there, blah, 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 and then they'll figure it out that way to come up with an absolute dollar amount for the goods, but they already know that it's got to be in the ratio of 1 to 2. So if an apple costs, what I say, one apple trades for two oranges, so maybe an apple is, what, $1 and an orange is 50 cents, so that one apple trades for two oranges. Okay, but if there's a lot of inflation and the number of dollars doubles, then, you know, oh, maybe an apple now is $2 and an orange is $1. Okay, so again, they use mainstream economists, the way they typically would look at this is they use marginal utility theory to explain the real exchange rate of goods directly against each other. But I think that's the way most economists are picturing it. And then they think that that's where the equilibrium prices come from in terms of goods trading directly against goods. And then, like I say, as an afterthought, they sort of overlay the fact that, oh, well, in the real world, everything trades against money. And so instead of saying how many apples trade for an orange, really we should say how many dollars does an apple trade for, and then multiply through and say and that's how many oranges must trade for a dollar also. Okay, so what Rothbard's getting at here is that that's, to think of the economy that way, you're totally missing the important role that money plays. That we, as we can see, it's not just that money is overlaid and then doesn't itself just change things. That we can see without using money, and more generally without having indirect exchange, you couldn't have a modern economy at all. You could barely have any specialization in terms of occupations, and you couldn't have large scale production. All right. The other thing in terms of while I'm on this point, let me say this so I don't, before I forget, I might be bouncing around the order that Rothbard does stuff in this chapter, but let me just mention, without money, you can't have economic calculation. Okay, so here, this is, it reaches its fullest expression with using money, and probably if you just have media of exchange, that might be a step in the right direction. I'd have to think that through more fully. But clearly, if you just have direct exchange, you're in trouble on this particular point that I'm going to spell out. And then when you have money, it's fine. And I think maybe as you move closer to having the money, the problem gets more and more contained, as it were. Okay, but again, the problem is with just using direct exchange, you don't have a common denominator. You don't have a single unit of account to which you can reduce everything else, and so you can't engage in what's called economic calculation. All right, so Will, if you stick around in these classes, we'll come back. This is a huge topic, but right now let me just give you the quick version of it. So the idea is, if you're a business enterprise, you need to know, are you earning a profit? Okay, or just more generally, you need to know, are you using resources effectively? Or is there something else that would be a better use of both your time, you know, your labor power, and also the physical resources at your command? And so the way, of course, that happens in a society that's using money is each business enterprise, you know, relying on accounting and so forth, can say, well, what's the monetary value of the resources that we're using up in our operation, and then what's the monetary value of the products and services we're creating? And then you just look at those two numbers, and you can see over a certain period of time, did we generate a net income or not, or did we suffer a loss? And so those things are quoted in or measured in, or they consist in, money prices. And so that's what money does, or that's one of the things that money does for us, is it allows you to compare goods that are actually very different. Okay, so if you didn't have that, if you just had direct exchange, or even indirect exchange where everybody's using a different medium of exchange and so forth, it would be pretty hard for you to figure that stuff out. Okay, that you could look at an operations building a house, for example, and you could just, and you'd say, well, okay, we're using, I'm making these numbers up, I have no idea, you know, 3,000 labor hours, and using so many pounds of lumber, and we're using so many nails, and so much glass, and so on and so forth, and then we're producing this house in this location that has this sort of characteristics, you know, this much square footage, this many bathrooms, and you know, this sort of look to it and what have you. And then so you wonder, when all is said and done, did we just waste our time and our resources, or was this a good thing? Should we do it again, for example, down the street? And if you didn't have money, how could you possibly answer that question? Because you would have to, you know, you could know the engineering facts. You could know this is how much labor we use, this is how much wood, blah, 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 blah. And you could list all the things, all the inputs that went into it, and you would know the output. You would know this is the house we ended up with. But that wouldn't tell you whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, okay? Because, so let me just clarify here. The question is not, do you like the house, okay? So it's not enough just to say, well, no, this is a really nice house. It, you know, it keeps me from getting wet if it's raining. It keeps me nice and warm if it's snowing outside. I can lock the door so burglars can't come in. This is a pretty cool thing. So the question's not, would you rather have the house or have it burned down? That's not the issue. The important issue is, given all the resources that it would take to build that house, does it make sense to build it? Okay, that's the idea. So, and that's what economic calculation helps us solve in a market economy, is because it allows us to attribute a single number to all the different types of inputs that are involved in the construction of the house, and a single number to the output. And those numbers are market prices. Okay, so that's it. And again, we'll come back to that later on. This is Mises' famous critique of socialism. But having seen Mises' critique, now we're sort of, you know, as Austrians, getting a bigger picture and understanding, oh, so that's one of the social functions of money in general, is that it allows us to understand which operations are using resources efficiently and which ones aren't. And so, of course, just to round out the discussion here, that's what money prices do, and that's the function of accounting and so forth, is it allows society to husband resources. So in a market economy, if a particular enterprise is suffering losses measured in monetary terms, unless they're just doing it for, you know, recreational reasons, or it's a philanthropy or something, and they know they're losing money and they're okay with that, they're going to change something. You know, they're going to either tweak it and try to save money, and or try to, you know, change the product to get more revenue, or they may shut down altogether. But the point is, they're not just going to keep something going on that's losing money. They're going to try to change it so it stops losing money. And that's what you want to have happen, because that's how it's like a built-in correction mechanism. So that at any given time, yeah, entrepreneurs are doing things that may not be correct, but they get feedback from market prices, and then they tweak things. And so that's, you know, the giant social apparatus of how do we distribute the decision making in a market economy to determine what's going to be done with our scarce resources. That process incorporates the fact that we have money, and that there are profit and loss statements that give feedback to people so they can change when they're wasting resources. Okay, so that's, and again, you need money to do that. So that's part of the Austrian view here, is to the importance, the tremendous importance of money. And you would not get that at all in a mainstream treatment. If anything, in a mainstream treatment, they would say the reason you have money is, like I said the thing before about the double coincidence of wants, that how could a teacher teach a third grade class stuff, because, you know, they would need to make separate barter arrangements with the parents of each of the kids. Yeah, that's like a typical way you get across the function of money in a more mainstream treatment. And they would talk about the fact that money, you know, is a store of value and stuff like that, but they would not be talking about the stuff I just went over. I don't think, or I've never seen a book that would discuss those things. Okay, so indirect exchange is the solution to all these problems of direct exchange. And here, what this is, this particular slide, is taken from my book, Lessons for the Young Economist. And there, I mean, it's, again, if you totally get what Rothbard's doing and you're fine with it, you don't need to go read this. But if it's a little bit opaque to you, or just a little bit out of your grasp, I break it down much more simply in Lessons for the Young Economist if you want to go look at the treatment there. So here, what I was going over, and just so you understand what this is talking about here, this slide, I was going over a scenario where there's a guy who has eggs and he has tattered shoes, so he wants the tailor to fix his shoes. But the tailor doesn't want eggs. The tailor wants, I think meat. I'm trying to see what this is. Is it bacon? Yeah, it looks like it's bacon. It's hard to read the print. But he wants bacon from the butcher, okay? And the problem, though, is the butcher doesn't need, his shoes are fine. Okay? So the point is, I'm trying to get you to see what indirect, so we're not even talking about money right now. This is just indirect exchange to show you the benefits of indirect exchange. So here, the point is with these three people, given their preferences, and so that's what those first, second, and third thing are, that's showing you their rankings of the three types of goods, the shoe repair service, the eggs, and the bacon. Those are their preference rankings for direct consumption. Okay, so if you're limited to direct exchange, there's no trade possible with these three people. Okay, there's no mutually advantageous trade, so they're all stuck with what they started out with. However, if we allow for the possibility of indirect exchange, what can happen? Well, the guy with the eggs trades them to the butcher in exchange for the bacon. Okay, so now the butcher is better off because he acquired eggs and he gave up his bacon. Okay, so the butcher's happier. Now, if that were the end of the story, it wouldn't be a win-win situation because the guy with the tattered shoes, he actually doesn't want bacon. That's third on his value scale. But he then takes the bacon and trades it away to the tailor who then repairs his shoes. Okay, so now because of that, everybody in this little society is better off. They've all moved up on their preference rankings. And so it's showing you that how indirect exchange is benefiting all these people, whereas if we were limited to direct exchange, they would have been stuck with what they started out with. Okay? So if you want to think of it like this, indirect exchange just allows more possibilities for rearranging goods to make people better off according to their subjective preferences. All right, the indirect exchange facilitates more examples of beneficial trades because some trades are more complicated than just one-off swaps. That, in other words, you need to do two or more trades before the whole cycle is completed and every single participant's better off. And so that's what indirect exchange allows for. So in this particular example, where the guy with the eggs gives the eggs to the butcher to get bacon and then uses the bacon to convince the cobbler to fix his shoes. In this example, the bacon would be a medium of exchange. Okay, so now we're going to talk about money and its origin. Actually, let me go back to that. Let me just define the term medium here. So it's medium of exchange. Okay, so the word medium, I don't know if this is going to translate well for people in other countries, but in English, if English is your first language, it should be okay. The word medium, it has several meanings. So a lot of people think it means sort of in between, like something could be, like if you're looking at sizes of, you're going to the restaurant and you want to get a Coke, and they say what size, you could say small, medium, or large. So there, the word medium, it means in between. And that's also what it kind of means in this context, but I think to see it better is if you're familiar with the phrase this way, a medium is something through which something travels. So in physics, you could say that air is a medium through which sound waves travel. So if I'm talking and you can hear me, there's vibrations that my vocal cords induce in the air, and that travels through the air to your inner ear and vibrates your, the bones in your ear. And that's how you get the information. Okay, so in that case, the air is a medium through which the sound waves travel. So here, in this example, in a sense, the bacon is a medium through which the ultimate trade is effected. That really what's happening from the farmer's point of view, the guy with the eggs, is he in the grand scheme, he's trading away his eggs to obtain shoe repair service, but he has to go through the medium of the bacon in order to do that. Okay, and so that's where this, that's the way to think about this term, medium of exchange. Okay, so now money in its origin. First of all, let me explain where we're going with this. So what is money? It's defined in the Austrian approach as a medium of exchange that is commonly accepted. Okay, so trades involving money are indirect exchanges, but they're a special kind. Okay, so you have direct exchange, and then you have indirect exchange, and those two don't intersect, right, because they're different. If something is a direct exchange, it's not an indirect exchange. So in terms of a Venn diagram, you know, putting circles around, if you had a whole universe of exchanges, you could divide the universe into direct exchanges and indirect exchanges. But then within the group that's indirect exchanges, some of them would involve money, whereas other ones wouldn't. Okay, so again, anytime there's an indirect exchange, a medium of exchange is involved, because in an indirect exchange, at least one person is obtaining something that he or she intends to trade away again. That's what makes the exchange indirect, and then that thing, the object that was acquired that the person is intending to trade away, that is a medium of exchange. Okay, it doesn't need to be money. However, that particular medium of exchange, if it's commonly accepted as such by people in the community, then it's a money. Okay, so if this helps you guys, not all media of exchange are money, but every money is a medium of exchange. Okay, so again, I'm belaboring the heck out of this, because if it clicks with you and you get this, it's very crystal clear and you'll totally get where the Austrians are coming from. If you're just saying, I'm not really going to care about these fine distinctions, then you're really not going to get the full impact of the Austrian view on money. So that's why I'm beating a dead horse here to make sure this sticks in, sticks with you, or sinks in. That's what I was going for. Okay, so now that you understand the definitions and the conceptual framework here, I can actually tell you the Austrian theory of the origin of money pretty quickly. That's why I spent so much time building this up. Now you should be able to get Menger's theory pretty quick. Okay, so again, just to make sure you didn't lose this point, this little story or narrative that I'm about to tell you, Karl Menger came up with. All right, so he was explaining the origin of money. All right, and so he, and again, Karl Menger, of course, is the founder, the pioneer of Austrian economics. So let me just mention one thing. Menger was reacting against, or he criticized, the state theory of money. Okay, so when Menger was developing his own views, a popular explanation for where did money come from was to say the state invented it, or maybe some, you know, wise king or some, you know, some wise elder of a tribe or what have you. But the idea was, a lot of people thought that, well, gee, we have this incredibly useful social thing. It's clearly made by man, right? It's not natural. It's not like a tree or a bacteria. Like, money is clearly something that was developed by humans. And so a natural thing, a natural explanation would be some ruler, some political leader at some point in the past, back when people were using barter, must have woken up one day and said, okay, I had an epiphany, and now we're going to use money, and that will make us a lot more productive. And so Menger was criticizing that theory, and he said that there's a couple problems with it. So for one thing, just the surface implausibility of it. Because on the face of it, the idea of money is crazy, right? The idea that, you know, just think it through, that some king wakes up one day and he says, okay, you know what? Right now, everybody, when you want to trade something, you give up something that's valuable only if someone's going to give you something that you value more than the thing you just gave up. But I don't think we should do that anymore. I think what you should do is we should all give up the stuff we want in exchange for something that maybe many of you don't even think is worthwhile at all. Like, let's say these shells that I just picked up off the beach. So from now on, if you want to sell something, you have to do it for, in exchange for these shells, even if you think the shell is useless. But don't worry, you're not going to get the, you know, short end of the stick on this, because the stuff that you want to get, that person will have to give you the thing for the shell too. So you're still going to be able to get what you ultimately wanted to get. It's just, I want you to go through the use of this shell. Okay, so can you imagine if somebody said that, people would think the guy was nuts. Because on the surface, it looks like that's a stupid thing to do, right? You could say, well, no, I mean, I already know what I want. Why don't I just go trade directly for the thing I want, right? So unless you have been born into and lived in a community that used money, it's actually very hard to see the benefits of money. Like, you can't even imagine how much more productive society could be using money if you had never used it before, okay? So one of the points is, it's just implausible that somebody could have been that brilliant to have come up with such a crazy scheme that actually is, you know, the work of a genius. All right. Another problem is, suppose some king did come up with that idea, and suppose the subjects were willing to go along with it, or some, you know, maybe he had enough threats behind to say, if you don't do this, I'm gonna chop your head off. And so people said, okay, we'll do it. Then still the problem would be, what price should he use? Okay, because just to say, okay, from now on we're going to use this shell as our money, and anytime you want to trade something, you have to first trade away the thing you're getting rid of and acquire shells, and then use the shells to get the thing you're ultimately after, that's not enough. Because the people would need to say, well, what are the prices of things quoted in shells? Okay, so how would it get off the ground? So you could say, you know, so let's say somebody was planning on trading away some eggs in order to get an axe, okay? So before the king's announcement, the people would have just gone and traded the, you know, found someone with an axe who wanted eggs, and they would have come upon a mutually advantageous price. But now they can't do that because the king says, no, you got to do it through shells. So the person with the eggs, you know, let's say originally they were in the habit, you know, the farmers, you know, the commonly accepted exchange ratio in that community would have been 1,000 eggs for one axe. That would have been the direct exchange ratio that would have happened before the king comes up with this crazy announcement. So you might say, oh, well, the people then who now have to, you know, who have the eggs and want to go get an axe, it's just a minor inconvenience from their point of view. They got to go get the shells. So they should just set the price. They should say, okay, well, we'll sell the eggs for the number of shells we need after we go look at the people selling axes and see how many shells they're charging, right? So to make sure I don't get ripped off, to make sure the purchasing power of my eggs doesn't drop in this new scenario, I'm going to have to charge enough for my eggs, for 1,000 eggs, so that however many shells that gets me, I can use that many shells to go buy an axe. But you see the problem. What we're trying to show here is the first person to set his price in terms of shells doesn't know what a shell is worth. So if he can't do it, how does the guy with an axe know how much to charge for his axe? Okay, you get the point that it's not enough to know what is the money commodity in this community. You need to know what is its purchasing power. In other words, how many units of the money trade for various other goods and services in this community? Just like in the United States, if I say, oh, the U.S. dollar is the monetary unit, you wouldn't, and I say, so, like, let's say you were in a time machine, and I dropped you somewhere randomly in the United States, you know, through history, and then came out, and you didn't know what year it was, and I said, the money is dollars, and I want you to cut my lawn, or I want you to paint my house, let's say, and I'm going to give you the materials, how much would you be willing to do it for? You know, how much do I have to pay you? If you don't know what year it is, you have no idea what to tell me. Because if it's the year 1800, then if you get paid, you know, $2, that might be a lot. But if it's today, you're going to want to get paid a heck of a lot more than that, okay, because you don't know what the purchasing power is, right? So that's the idea. All right, so you get the idea of the problems with assuming some wise person just created money out of his head, and then everyone just started using it because of a command or like a central plan. Okay, so can Menger come up with a theory then that evades those difficulties? And he does. Okay, so before I tell you what the theory is, let me tell you what it's going to do. He is going to give an explanation that doesn't involve anybody from scratch inventing money. He's just going to show how people acting step by step in their own immediate self-interest, not perceiving the full implications of what they're doing, are going to gradually develop money. All right, so this is an example of what I think Adam Ferguson referred to as a product of human action, but not of human design. Okay, and that's, so again, the something that the product of human action, but not of human design, and Hayek really liked that phrase and picked that up. Okay, and so and this, of course, is the idea of spontaneous order that Hayek in particular really stressed. Okay, so again, I haven't told you yet. I'm just setting you up to appreciate the majesty. I mean, I'm really, I mean, this what Menger does here, it's really impressive. Okay, so again, he's going to explain the origin of money without needing to assume that some genius in the past invents the idea. He's just going to show how it just gradually develops. Okay, so the starting point for Menger's theory or his story is to say, let's go back in time. There must have been a point before money existed, and in fact, before even indirect exchange existed, when everything was just direct exchange. Okay? And now he said, even in that world, some goods would have been more marketable than others. Okay? And the actual direct translation of the term Menger used was saleable. Okay? And so I think it's easier to think of it in terms of marketable or liquid, if you like that word. Okay? So right at this stage, I want to just stress marketability or saleability or liquidity is a different characteristic from market value. Okay, so for example, a $20 bill is much more liquid than a house, but a house obviously has a much higher value, a market value, than a $20 bill. Okay, so what does marketability mean? The way I like to define it, it means how quickly can you obtain what is likely to be the best price for something you're trying to sell. Okay, so a gold watch is a lot more marketable than your car. Because if you had to sell your gold watch, you are likely to get the best price you're going to get after searching, you know, maybe for a few days. Whereas if you're trying to sell your car and you want to get the best price for it, you might have to devote a few weeks to finding the right buyer. Okay, and it's even worse, of course, with a house. If you're trying to sell a house, you know, it might take you a few months to get what you think is, you know, the market price. Okay, so that's what I'm getting at here is a lot of economists outside the Austrian school, when they talk about the market price of something, they're not taking into account the real world fact that it takes a long time sometimes to find the right buyer, the buyer who's going to pay that market price. Because in reality, if you have to sell a house, you know, let's say you're really in trouble. You know, you just need to come up with, you know, the mob's after you or something, and you need to come up with a lot of money very quickly, you know, you might, and maybe the only thing you have, the only asset you have, is to sell your house. You could sell it pretty quickly. You know, you could probably sell your house in terms of finding a buyer and signing a contract and so on within a day or two if you charged a really ridiculously low price, okay, and the person, you know, believed that you weren't crazy or something. You know, if a person could understand that, no, I really just need to come up with money fast, you could probably sell your house very quickly. So when we say casually that, oh, yeah, if you're going to sell your house, it might take you 6 months, we don't actually – it's actually not true. You could sell your house a lot more quickly, but what we mean is if you were willing to wait and keep the price high and hope to find the right buyer, you know, how much do you think you can get for it? That's what we mean, okay? So there's no question you could sell a house or a car pretty quickly, but you might have to charge a lot less than you ultimately would be able to get if you had more time to keep it on the market and to search for potential buyers. That's the idea. Whereas things that are very liquid, you don't have to worry about that. So if you have corporate stock, you know, you have shares of IBM stock and the price, whatever, is $10 right now, you don't have to search very long to find someone willing to pay you $10 for it. Now, you know, don't get confused. If you wait, you might get a higher price, but that's because the market price would have gone up. It's not because you found a different buyer, if you get what I'm saying. All right. So so back to Menger's story, he's saying this difference between marketability and value, that back even in direct exchange, you would have that distinction, that there would be some things that people would know could fetch very valuable items, you know, would trade for a lot of units of something else, but that it would be hard, it would take you a long time to find the appropriate buyer. Okay, so here what I'm showing you in these pictures is eggs are pretty marketable, but they have a low value, whereas a fancy telescope is not marketable at all, but it might have a very high value. Okay, so so the idea is, let's say you happen to have this telescope, like maybe your uncle died and he gives you in his will this amazing telescope, but you're not an astronomer, you can't use it, and you want to sell it, and you want to get some, I don't know, ham. Okay, now, if you were limited to direct exchange, you would have to go find somebody who had a bunch of ham and who wanted to get a really fancy telescope. So what are the chances you're going to find such a person? You might have to wait years to find the right, you know, astronomer-type person who also has a bunch of ham. So Menger's point is, all you need to do, or you get closer to your goal, if you can trade that telescope for what you think it's, you know, a fair price is, even if the things you're accepting you don't directly want. But as long as you're getting something that's more marketable than that stupid telescope, then you're one step closer to your goal. So that's the idea that Menger said what people do in that situation. People who are coming to market carrying very unmarketable or illiquid items, they often won't, you know, if they happen to find the person that has the thing they ultimately want, great. But what they may do, and here's another subtlety too. Suppose the guy with the telescope finds somebody with ham who wants a telescope, but the guy only has like 2 pounds of ham. And he says, oh yeah, I'd love to get a telescope, and I have some ham, I have 2 pounds. The guy with the telescope might think, no, this telescope I know is worth way more than 2 pounds of ham. I'm not going to sell it to you for 2 pounds of ham. Now, that's a very interesting statement if you think about it, right? What does he mean when he says this telescope is worth more than 2 pounds of ham? In a direct, literal sense, no, it's not. Because he's looked around the whole community, and nobody at that moment is willing to give him more pounds of ham than this guy who's offering him two. But what it means, the sense in which he can say that it'd be crazy for me to trade this valuable telescope for 2 pounds of ham is he knows there's somebody out there that wants this telescope that would be willing to give me goods that I could then, through further trades, use to acquire ultimately more than 2 pounds of ham. That's what he means. And so the person who comes to market with an illiquid good may have to engage in a series of trades to maximize what he ends up coming home with in terms of the ultimate target good. Because, like, going through indirect mechanisms or routes, he might be able to end up with more units of the ultimate thing than just to, right off the bat, try to say, who has the stuff that I ultimately want? I have this telescope, make me an offer. All right? So, for example, if there's somebody who has a bunch of eggs and is an astronomy aficionado and says, holy cow, I'll give you 20,000 eggs for that thing, even if the guy hates eggs, he might do it because he knows there's lots of people with ham who want eggs. There's not a lot of people with ham who want this telescope, but I know I'm going to be able to unload eggs. And so if I trade the telescope for 20,000 eggs, I'm going to be able to find people who have lots of ham who are willing to trade me for the eggs, and then I'll end up going home with a lot more than 2 pounds of ham, okay, when all is said and done. All right, so that's the idea. So notice what's happened there. The people who come to market with the illiquid things, if they can't find, you know, the right buyer right off the bat, what's their next best alternative is they trade their illiquid item to people who are giving them a good price in some other commodity, so long as that other commodity is more marketable than the thing they started out with. And if it's close, like if there's lots of people who want your illiquid thing and they're all offering you, you know, good prices in the sense that I defined it a minute ago, other things equal, you're going to go towards the people who are the person offering you the most marketable item for it, right? So if one person is offering you 20,000 eggs and somebody else is offering you, I don't know, 3 surfboards, even if 3 surfboards is actually a pretty good price, you know, in terms of the market and the way it is, you might just pick the 20,000 eggs because you're going to say, yeah, a surfboard is more marketable than a telescope, but actually a surfboard is still pretty illiquid. And so I'm not really helping myself all that much by trading the telescope for 3 surfboards, whereas, boom, if the guy who's giving me 20,000 eggs, I'm fine. I have no problem getting ham for the eggs. Okay, so you see the distinction? So what happened there is the things that are initially more marketable in a state of pure barter, once we allow for indirect exchanges to occur, the marketability of the most marketable things gets enhanced because now you've got people accepting them just because, for whatever reason, they were more marketable to begin with, that, you know, there were a lot of people who liked those things. Because remember, that's what it means to be marketable, that there are a lot of people who are willing to accept them in exchange, that there's a big market for them. Okay, so the reason eggs are marketable is because lots of people like eggs. So there's lots of people in the community who would trade their stuff to get more eggs. So the point is now we see even somebody who initially hates eggs, who in a world of pure direct exchange would never accept eggs in trade, that person now will accept eggs because he knows he can use them to then trade to somebody else. Okay, so now the marketability of eggs versus the telescopes is magnified because now not only the people who like eggs, but even the people who don't like eggs will accept them in trade. And so the superiority of eggs versus telescopes is magnified. Okay, so that's the snowballing process. That's the method by which things that are initially, you know, more marketable, it snowballs and they become more and more marketable because you've got people accepting them because of their marketability, besides their direct usefulness. Okay, so you can see where this is going, of course. Once that starts happening, Menger says, ultimately, a few goods become so marketable that basically the whole community accepts them. And then once that happens, boom, that's what money is. That's how money emerges. Okay, so notice in that story, nobody had any clue of what was going to come at the end. Nobody was thinking, oh, what can we do to develop money? Just no, individual people who start out with illiquid things are trading them to get more liquid things to you know, ultimately get the thing they want. and then that process makes those things more marketable, and then ultimately, once something is so marketable that you know just about everybody is going to be willing to sell whatever they have in exchange for that thing, as long as the price is right, then that thing is a money. So that's where money comes from. Okay? Let me clarify something. A lot of times when we talk about money, let me go back a slide. So again, in the Austrian view, the definition of money, what makes something a money, is that it's a medium of exchange that's commonly accepted. Okay? Now, some of the popular attributes of money, which I don't have a slide for, I should have made a slide for this, some of the popular attributes of money are things like it's very durable, it's easily divisible, it has a homogeneous composition, and what else? Oh, and it has a convenient market value relative to its physical weight and so forth and volume. Okay? So those are attributes typical to, you know, those are things that make a money good, but those are not the definitions of money, or those things are not part of the definition of money. Because from the Austrian view, the definition is this, that money is a medium of exchange that's commonly accepted, but those things I talked about, those attributes, help explain why certain goods become money. Okay, so let's go back to this example here with the eggs. You know, eggs are obviously much better media of exchange than a telescope because of the humongous advantage they have in terms of the initial size of the market. But there's lots of reasons, of course, that eggs actually wouldn't be great as a medium of exchange. Just think about it. To the example I used, you give the telescope away, you get 20,000 eggs, you're probably going to break a lot of those eggs. Also, it's going to be hard to transport them around. Okay, so you see the eggs there fail on the criteria of physical durability and a convenient market value relative to their weight and volume. Right, so in other words, in order to do large-scale purchases, large meaning in terms of market value, you need a lot of eggs, okay? And so that's not convenient. So that's why eggs, you know, once the Industrial Revolution took off and the whole world was going towards capitalism, that's why people weren't trading in eggs, right? And you see why gold and silver, the precious metals, are such excellent monies, is because they're good on all of those criteria. And so that's why they outstripped the other commodities in the race to see which one would become the most marketable. Okay, so in a more primitive society, you know, you could imagine initially that actually gold and silver, you know, they might have been nice to look at and whatever, but you would think like tobacco and eggs and things would be more marketable initially, and they probably were, but the point is the other attributes of gold and silver must have made them more desirable as media of exchange until, you know, and so again, once that process snowballed, then they just blew things out of the water once they became more marketable. Okay, so let me just rephrase that. So you can imagine somebody who, you know, he's got his telescope and one guy's offering him 20,000 eggs, and the other guy's offering him a pound of silver. And even if it were still at a stage in the development of the economy where the eggs are a lot more marketable than the silver is, still the guy might with the telescope might think, it is going to be a pain for me to take delivery of 20,000 eggs and to move them around. A lot of them are going to break. Also, you know, let's say I go to sell them to somebody for the ham that I want. The guy is going to say, well, have the eggs gone bad? You know, how long have you been carting them around, and let me inspect them, and how do I know that these are all grade A eggs and so forth? You know, I don't know what these things are. I need to test the quality. Okay, whereas if I get a pound of silver, it's going to be a lot easier for me to move around. Whether I buy the ham today or 3 weeks from now, the silver is not going to rot on me, whereas the eggs will go rotten if I don't get rid of them quickly. again, if I drop it, it's not going to break. And when I ultimately do find the buyer, he's going to be able to inspect the silver and pretty quickly determine if he thinks it's high quality or not, as opposed to, you know, the eggs. Okay, so you can see how, even though it might be harder to find someone who wants silver and who wants to get rid of ham, the guy selling the telescope might take the silver just because that's such an easier thing to use as a medium of exchange than the eggs are. And so you can see how, even if initially gold and silver weren't all that marketable, once people got the hang of indirect exchange and how it worked, you could see why, as long as it was even close, they might prefer to sell the really illiquid things in exchange for precious metals as opposed to something like eggs. Okay, so that's the relationship between the definition of money and then the attributes commonly associated with a good money. Okay, and then the last point is the unit of money. And so here Rothbard says that he makes a pretty strong statement, and I'm surprised he didn't like at least have a footnote or something to explain it to the reader. He says, look, the unit of money is always its weight. And so if it's gold, you know, like how many ounces of gold or pounds or what have you, or grams or grains, they think that, you know, that what that's measuring is the physical weight. And I have a picture here of cigarettes because if you read there's a pretty famous article called The Economics of a POW Camp. And so what happened is in World War II, this guy who was an economist was in the war effort, and I forget who he was fighting for. And he got captured, so he's in POW camp, and he's just, you know, observing stuff as an economist. And then he wrote up his experiences later. It's actually a pretty fascinating article. And what became money in the POW camp was cigarettes, but more specifically the tobacco in them, because the Red Cross or whoever would give out care packages, or I don't know what you want to call them, for the maintenance of the POWs, you know, make sure they didn't starve to death or whatever. And so the prison camp authorities would go ahead and hand that stuff out, or let the Red Cross hand them out. And one of the standard ration things in there were cigarettes. And so those became, in the camp, that was the, you know, first there was indirect exchange, and then they just became money. That ultimately everybody dealt with, you know, traded against cigarettes. Even non-smokers would always want to have cigarettes on their possession because they knew they could use the cigarettes to obtain whatever they wanted. And they, you know, and it got pretty complicated. Like, they actually had chalkboards with prices of stuff. You know, like, they had markets, you know, market prices that were posted in this camp. I mean, so it's pretty cool. And one of the things the guy said is that the way they, you know, that ultimately it was the amount of tobacco that was the determinant of the actual price. So I believe here, this is from memory. I haven't read in a while, so I might be a little bit off, but I'm pretty sure he said that the way they, you know, the actual, you know, quote was in cigarettes. So you could say, oh, that thing costs a half a cigarette, that thing costs, you know, three cigarettes. But he said if there was ever any doubt as to what that really meant, he said it meant the amount of tobacco that would fill a standard cigarette. And he said, because otherwise, you know, you could try to cheat somebody by, you know, taking a regular cigarette and, you know, rolling a little bit and trying to get the tobacco out and doing that way. And so he said that, you know, if there's ever any issue, and he said especially for large transactions, you know, the people might, I don't know if they, like, unrolled all the tobacco or something. I forget exactly what they did. But the point is, even though they might have quoted the prices in cigarettes, if you gave somebody a cigarette that looked like it didn't have all the tobacco in it, you know, the person could say, this isn't a full cigarette, this isn't a real cigarette, and give me a real cigarette. And that, you know, ultimately the criterion would be how much tobacco is in a standard issue cigarette. Okay, so that's where Rothbard's coming from. Now, what I meant when I said I'm surprised he didn't at least put in a footnote something to allay the suspicious reader, obviously in our economies today, with fiat money, you can say, what are you talking about? Things are quoted in terms of the monetary unit, you know, the currency, and there's no such thing, you know, you can't say how many grams is a dollar weigh. That doesn't even make any sense. So what does Rofford mean when he says money is always measured in terms of its physical dimensions, namely its weight? Well, what Rofford means is, right now, remember, he's talking about a market economy. And so Rofford thinks that in a market economy, money is always going to be an actual commodity that at least at one point was valued directly for the services it could provide, not because of its non-monetary, or sorry, not because of its monetary function. And so so that's where he's coming from. So he's really just, without saying explicitly, but in that passage where he says, in a market economy, money is always measured or according to its, or defined according to its weight, he's implicitly saying there that fiat money is a creation of the state, and that there would be no fiat money in a genuine market without, you know, the government coming in and imposing it through various mechanisms. Okay, so I think we'll stop. Well, let me just say one more thing. So what he's getting at, also referring to historically, what we now think of as national currencies, they didn't used to be fiat. They used to be tied to the precious metals. Okay, so like the U.S. dollar, for example, was defined as a certain amount of silver. Okay, and then later on they went to a gold standard, and so you had $20.67 in U.S. currency entitled you to 1 ounce of gold. Okay, so the reason U.S. citizens carried around green pieces of paper with pictures of presidents on them originally was that those things were paper claims, certificates that entitled you to what the real money was, the gold or the silver. Okay, and then it was only through a bunch of crimes, basically, that the government severed that link and got Americans to use green pieces of paper that weren't backed up by anything. And of course, there was a similar process in other countries with, you know, the franc and the British pound and so forth. Okay, let me now turn to your questions for this week. Okay, I got to log back in because it kicked me out. Almost there. Okay, Lewis says, in order for a commodity to be regarded as money, besides being accepted as a common medium of exchange, does it need to keep any direct use value, always subjectively speaking, of course, remaining in addition to its growing exchange value deriving from widening acceptance on the market? Okay, let me paraphrase what he said to make sure you guys followed that. So under Menger's theory of the origin of money, in a market economy, the money historically must have been at one point just a regular commodity. It must have been valued for its own sake, for its use either as consumption or as a production good. And then it just, you know, people started accepting it in indirect exchange, and then, you know, ultimately became a money. But the point is, originally, people used it for other reasons. They didn't use it just because it was money. And so Lewis is asking, does it have to be the case that people still use it for something besides its monetary purpose? And the answer is no. It's theoretically possible that, you know, there could be a commodity, like, let's say gold, like a market economy, people could be using gold, it's theoretically possible that people just stop liking gold jewelry. I'm trying to think of, like, for some reason, suppose human genetics change, and so it gets to the point where, for some reason, to actually be in contact with gold is painful, or it makes you sick. Like, gold turns into kryptonite for humans. It's possible that, you know, the economy is so developed and whatever that, you know, what they end up doing is they still use it as money, but they take all the physical gold and they put it in a vault somewhere on the moon, and then what we use, you know, we just trade 100% backed paper certificates that entitle you to those things on the moon. Okay? I mean, that's a little bit fanciful, and maybe in that search, you know, you might say in that scenario, something else might arise and replace the gold that people could actually hold physically. But I'm just saying, you know, that's praxeology wouldn't rule that out. You know, Austrian economics per se wouldn't rule that out. It might be very unlikely. Okay, but what is true is that anything that's used as money, at least according to Murray Rothbard, anything that's used as money historically must have been a commodity or was linked to something that historically wasn't once a commodity. So that, for example, right now, you know, US dollars, fiat money, that is money. It's a commonly accepted medium of exchange. Okay, so it meets the definition. So even in terms of Austrian economics, US dollars right now and the euro and the Japanese yen and so forth, those are all money. I mean, they're not as good a money as a truly market-based one would be, most Austrians would say. But the point is, they are money, and obviously they were never used as commodities before. So the way the Austrians explain that is they say, well, it's because they used to be linked to money, and that's why people held them. And then once the link was severed, people, you know, they were in a habit, and there's all kinds of government coercion involved, but they ended up using those things even though they were fiat money. Okay, getting mixed up here. All right. Okay, Lewis says, Dr. Murphy, in the study guide on page 27, you ask, what's the price of money? Is it correct to answer that it's the amount of goods and services that can be obtained in exchange for each monetary unit? Yes, that's correct. So it's a little bit, and I think we're going to get more into this next lecture, but, you know, I'll answer your question. So the tricky thing with money is it's the reciprocal of the way you're used to thinking about it. So if a, I'm going to use dollars just because it's, I think it's more natural for people than to talk about gold ounces. So if the price of a car is $10,000, what does that mean? You say the price of a car is $10,000. It means if you want to acquire a car, you have to trade away 10,000 units of money for it. So then if I say, okay, well, that's what the price of a car is, but what's the price of money? Well, I could say, oh, well, the price of $1 bill is 1/10,000th of this car. Or going the other way, the price of $10,000 bills is one car. But the weird thing with money is since money is on one side of every transaction, if you ask what's the price of any good and service besides money, all you really need to do is say how many units of money it trades for. So if I say, what's the price of a haircut? What's the price of a horse? What's the price of this house? The person who answers me can just give me one number and say that many units of money. But if I say, what's the price of money? It's really not enough just to say, oh, it's 1/10,000th of this car, because that only gives me a little bit of information. That tells me what the exchange rate is between dollars and that car, but I don't know what the exchange rate is between dollars and everything else. And so yes, you're right, Lewis. When you say what's the price of money, typically we mean what is its purchasing power in general, you know, various types of goods and services, how many units of those things do you have to give up to get a unit of money? Okay, and then Joe Smith says, Okay, and this is the last question, so that's why I'll answer it, even though it's off topic. He says, it's off topic for this week, but if you're familiar with the situation, could you speak to the oil speculation manipulation charges being brought against Parnon, Arcadia Petroleum, and Arcadia Energy? Do you feel there's any merit to the charges? Yeah, this actually came up at the hearing in which I testified yesterday. I only read like a New York Times article, so I'm not an expert on this, but I think the main claim is, so the CFTC, the Commodities Futures and Trading Commission, they brought formal charges against these companies, and they said that what they did was, in I think it was like between January and March of 2008, they said that these guys were manipulating the inventories of crude oil, I think in Cushing, Oklahoma, because that's a place where there's a lot of crude inventory that's, you know, held there, because I guess it's near refineries or something, or that's for some reason that's a place where the crude is taken for delivery. So for whatever reason, you know, one of the popular prices is for West Texas International, so WTI, I believe, is the price of Cushing oil. Okay, so the point is, when you say what's the price of oil today, there's actually not a single number. There's different benchmarks you could use, and so one of the benchmarks is the price of oil at Cushing, which is a city in Oklahoma, and so. So what these guys were doing apparently is they accumulated physical inventory. So they were buying up a lot of the oil inventory at Cushing, and then so that was making it look like oil was really tight, and so that was pushing up the futures price of oil. So people in this futures market where you're buying and selling not the actual barrels of oil per se, you're not taking physical delivery, but you're buying and selling promises to deliver oil like in 1 month time or 3 months time or 6 months time. So you do that, and then the price that you're agreeing upon is the futures price in whatever the timetable is for delivery. And so the idea is, if people think right now that, uh-oh, there's not a lot of physical crude oil, that might push up the futures price, because it looks like there's a shortage. So, very loosely, and again, I don't know the full details, what these guys were charged with doing is sort of, you know, hoarding the physical oil to push up the futures price. And, you know, and so they must, you know, so they must have bought futures contracts first, hoarded the oil, the price went up, and then I think they sold their futures contracts and then dumped the physical oil and crashed the price. Okay, so they were just doing short-term. You know, so they didn't ultimately want to use the oil. They were just going to come and buy it up. And because they knew they were going to buy up such a huge portion of it, they knew that it was going to push up the futures price. So they got their ducks in a row in the futures market, come in, buy the physical oil, that pushes up the futures price. Then they know they're going to dump the physical oil, so they close out their futures positions, you know, take their profits, maybe even go the other way, and then dump the physical oil, and that pushes down the futures price, and they profit on the way down too. I think that's the basic idea. And so so that's called manipulating the market, and I think it's illegal. I don't know the exact regulations and what you can do or not do to be charged with that, but if they did do that, and apparently they have a lot of stupid emails that they sent to each other that make it look like they quite consciously were doing that. So when you say is there a merit to the charge, they probably did break the law that exists, or at least, you know, assuming the facts as reported by the New York Times is correct. But if you're asking me, should it be illegal to do what they did, I would say no. That you know, this is kind of like the issue of insider trading too. That I mean, it's you want to have futures markets. They're there so that if there is a physical shortage, you know, the price responds. and that's what you want to have happen. Okay, that's part of the function of futures markets is to warn people if they think there's going to be a shortage. And so if some speculator anticipates a shortage and they think the future price of oil is going to be higher, they buy futures contracts that pushes up the futures price. And what does that do? That gives a signal to producers to start producing more. And for people right now, if the current price is lower, they could buy inventory and store it for the future. They, you know, just sell it in the future. So that's what you want to have happen. Okay. Now, in this case, the reason it's a little bit odd is it looks like, you know, these guys were creating the scarcity that then the market was responding to, that it wasn't real. Okay. They were, in other words, they like tricked people. So, you know, if the story, if it's exactly as the situation says, you know, it's, they didn't defraud anybody in terms of a Rothbardian sense. It's not like they said to somebody, I'll give you $100 for that barrel of oil, and then they wrote them a bad check. Or it's not that they bought some oil and said to someone, hey, this is, you know, light, sweet crude from this particular field, and then they sold them something that was not, you know, that was sour crude or something. I mean, that would be genuine fraud where they lied to their customers and ripped people off. So as far as I can tell, there's no accusation that they did that. It's just, you know, they bought a bunch of physical oil and people responded a certain way and then they sold it. So I don't see why that's, you know, so now what would happen if people realize that's what happened? Maybe they're going to be more careful in the future. And they're not going to just naively look at the changes in physical stocks. You know, they might be wary and say, wait a minute, is somebody doing what these clowns did back in early 2008? Okay, so to be clear, I'm not saying that if they did profit from this, that necessarily served a social function, because it looked like they just, you know, artificially created the scarcity that the prices were reacting to. But again, by the same token, I don't think that they hurt anything in terms of ripping people off, literally, you know, defrauding them. And I think the market would quickly adapt to that sort of thing. Also, just in general, some of the charges I saw said that maybe they moved oil prices by $1 per barrel. Okay, so it's not like the huge run-up in oil prices in early 2008 is because of these guys. And also, like, in terms of the timing, I think they were done with their stuff by April. And if you look at a chart of oil prices, yeah, they rose somewhat from January to April of 2008, but they really took off from, like, May to July is when they really went through the roof. So, I mean, it's possible other people were doing schemes like these guys, but the point is, were these particular firms responsible for oil hitting record prices in the summer of 2008? I don't think so. All right, well, we're out of time. Good questions, everybody, and thanks for tuning in. And we'll see you next time. I'll have your multiple choice thing posted by tomorrow, so it'll be ready by tomorrow morning for you to take the quiz, for those of you taking the class for credit. All right, thanks, everybody.